So we've been talking about stories. Your life is a story being played out. My life is a story being played out. And our faith, of course, proposes itself as the grandest of stories where everyone fits, everyone belongs, and everyone has a part to play. And if this is so, if life and faith are story, then it raises the question that we need to talk about in its character. If life is a story, then how do we become the character we're supposed to play? If our faith is a story, then how do we develop a character that is ours to play? I'm not sure if you remember, if you can think back through your own story history, the very first time a character jumped out to you in either a film or a TV show or book. For me, I remember it was 1993 and Tombstone came out. The story of Wyatt Earp and the showdown at the OK Corral. And Val Kilmer's character, Doc Holliday, was just mesmerizing. His character was magnetic to watch. He was, of course, a man riddled with tuberculosis, a drunk with a razor-sharp sense of wit. He was a sharpshooter with his pistol, but he was also haunted by personal demons looking for redemption. It was impossible not to be drawn in by this character. He was hilarious and sharp at the same time. At one point in the film, he's accused of being too drunk to shoot at anyone. Someone, his nemesis enemy, says, "You're too drunk, you're probably seeing two of me right now," to which he replies, "I've got two guns, one for each of you." In fights, he would constantly have no idea what it means, but he would say to them, "I'm your Huckleberry." It's like, I don't know what that means, but it sounded daunting, him just saying it that way. And then in the final scene, he saves his friend Wyatt Earp's life, this man who had been killing people. It was an awful scene in the West, and he fights for justice, and at the very end, he defeats the man who had been causing problems, was going to kill his friend Wyatt Earp, and he says to him, "You're no Daisy, you're no Daisy at all." And I was like, I don't know what that means, but I 100% agree. He was no Daisy. It was no Daisy, and it was this amazing character that you couldn't take your eyes off of, and he finally finds redemption at the end of his life because he was able to stand up for courage and justice, and it was remarkably compelling. And I mean, if you think about your favorite story, be it from a novel or film or television, chances are this: if you consider your favorite story, you might today forget specific aspects or details of the plot, but what you probably haven't forgotten are the characters. Now, why is that? Why is it that characters and stories etch themselves into our minds? I've come to think this: we are drawn to in story, what we're drawn to in story is watching compelling characters make difficult choices. Watching or reading about humans making complex choices, it dazzles us. And so I think you could say this: the heart of any good story, any great story, is compelling characters making complex choices. It's the recipe for a good story. And so what any author or filmmaker or storyteller is doing, the task in front of them is to create a character that can withstand the weight of the difficult decisions that a storyteller throws at them, whether that's for good or ill. I mean, consider Walter White, Breaking Bad. Imagine halfway through the story, he says, "This is too stressful. I'm just going to forget drug dealing." You'd be like, well, that's not a story worth listening to. No. He had to live into his values. Or consider The Underwoods and House of Cards. If they said, you know what, halfway through, maybe we don't love power that much. Let's just forget this whole thing. Or Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games. Imagine she said, you know, it does suck living in tyranny, but I don't care enough to do anything about it. It doesn't make a good story. And so again, for good or ill, stories place characters in the position of having to make very difficult decisions. Without that, we have no story, at least not worth reading or telling or watching. And I think there's something informative about that for us as we consider our lives as story and our faith as story. A good story requires characters that can carry the weight of making complex and difficult decisions. And again, we're attracted to characters because we love watching or reading about people make tough decisions. We're drawn to tales of fellow human beings making hard choices because I think what it does is it reminds us of our own choices, the hard choices we'll inevitably face, or at the very least it raises the question, what would I do if I was faced with that decision? Would I have the courage of a Katniss Everdeen? Would I, under the right or wrong circumstances, would I end up following Walter White's trajectory? We love stories because we're attracted to watching people make tough choices. And I think what story does is functions as a mirror for us. What would you do? And these stories prepare us for our own stories and to make our own difficult decisions. Because the truth is this, I think. We find our character in life at the crux of difficult decisions. Consider this famous story of Jesus in John 8. It's one story that many, many people love. It's one of the favorite stories of Jesus, but there's something fascinating going on here. It says this, at dawn he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. And as he's teaching, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law of Moses, we are commanded to stone such a woman. Now what do you say?" He's got a choice, a very difficult choice in front of him. On the one hand, he carries the fate of this woman's life in his hands. On the other, for him to go against a mob mentality rule could endanger his own life. And you know, it's interesting because this story might seem primitive to us in a certain sense, but at its core, this story is about something more than ancient laws. The story places Jesus in a real dilemma. It places him in a tough spot. It puts a harsh decision in his hands. Does he have enough character to stand up against public morality? Does he have the fortitude to resist mob mentality? What exactly is Jesus made of? Because we're about to find out. Because it's one thing to say you're for mercy. It's quite another to show mercy when all the forces around you are pushing for exactly the opposite. Are his values of mercy and compassion, are they strong enough to resist the crowd? That is a relatable question. A year ago, I was at a big U2 show in Toronto in Skydome, Rogers Center. And a number of us, people who are odd, waited for a long time in line so we could get right to the front. And it was scorching hot. It was just, Finally, the doors opened and we ran and we crashed the field and we had another 2 or 3 hours to wait before the show began. So we're all hanging on the front rails, hanging on to our spots. And about a half an hour before the show began, a couple moseyed on in. They had not been waiting in line and they moseyed on in and just snuck their way right up to the front. And people lost it. It was just, oh. It was unbelievable to me the way a mob mentality works and the sense of justice. Immediately someone pointed out, whoa, 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 you weren't waiting in line. We've been waiting for hours to get these spots. You can't cut in line. And then other people started joining the fray. Get them out of here. Get them out of here. It was interesting to me, when there's mob mentality, there's two types of people. The people calling for their heads and the people like me who just stay silent. And I just sat there, kind of intrigued by what was going to happen, and the mob mentality just kept rising and rising, and I thought, where is the person, now I could have thought maybe I should do this, where's the person who might say, hey everybody, why don't we just simmer down a bit, it's just a show, we're all going to have fun, but nobody did, and eventually security had to come and pull them out, make them, get them out of line, and I thought, wow. The mob mentality is powerful. It's hard to resist. Have you ever seen a social media pile on? Somebody says something stupid online and then jump. Like a missile. It's like everybody piles on. And where are the voices saying, let's show some compassion, some grace. You know, it's interesting to me how we respond to and handle the pressure of difficult decisions in life ultimately determines who we are. It determines our character because all choice is rooted in values. And it's easy enough to say we value things like forgiveness, compassion, grace, love. But who we are and our character is not defined by a list of values. It's defined by our actions, our choices. Our character is defined by the choices we make every single day, big and small. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, our character can at times be fairly weak. Chances are you didn't extend compassion or forgiveness to someone this week. And that says something about you and about me. Because if you can't extend those values to people in ordinary settings, what chance do you have at doing it in the larger areas of life? And so the question becomes, how do we develop our character then? If our lives are going to tell a meaningful story, how do we develop our characters? How does that happen? Well, I want us to consider this morning Huckleberry Finn. And bar none, I'm just going to throw it down and say he's the greatest fictional character ever created. In fact, if you haven't read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, I believe you are poor for it, but what do I know? I don't read a lot of fiction. But I believe he is an absolutely brilliant character created by Mark Twain. And the brilliance of the story is that Mark Twain allows Huckleberry Finn to tell his own story. And it's what makes the novel so powerful. The story, in short, is this. Huck Finn is a typical boy in pre-Civil War era. And he's been raised in a harsh upbringing. His father's an alcoholic and beats him. And so Huck finds himself under the care of a woman, a plantation owner named Miss Watson. She's nice enough, but she's strict, and she's a slave owner. And at one point, Huck's alcoholic father returns and kidnaps him. And so Huck decides he's going to run away and steal down the Mississippi River. And in the process, he runs into Jim, a runaway slave from Miss Watson's plantation. Jim learned that he was about to be sold away from his family, so he decided to run instead. And the rest of the book, the majority of the book, is the story of the two of them and the adventures they find themselves in traveling down the Mississippi River. And that's the basic plot line, but the central preoccupation of the entire story, what Mark Twain seems to be after, is this. How do we make decisions, and how is our character formed? Huck Finn, I would say, is this. He's the timeless archetype of adolescent innocence, meaning adult experience. And throughout the story, he's faced with so many hard choices. And the book, the brilliance of it, is that it's a microcosm of the hard choices that were facing the United States before the Civil War. And I would say the hard choices that are still facing that nation and our own in a number of ways. And in this story, Mark Twain beautifully captures the way Huckleberry Finn agonizes and rationalizes and analyzes the choices in front of him. And we're given this delightful, humorous peek into the human condition. How do we make decisions? Here's an early struggle that Huckleberry Finn faces around the ethics of stealing food, and I think it's delightful. It says this, I'll try some sort of, we'll see if an accent works. Mornings before daylight, I slipped into cornfields and borrowed a watermelon or a mushmelon or pumpkin or some corn or things of that kind. Pap always said it weren't no harm to borrow things if he was meaning to pay them back sometime. But Miss Watson said it weren't anything but a soft name for stealing. No decent body would do it. Now, Jim said he reckoned Miss Watson was partly right and Pap was partly right. So the best way would be for us to pick out two or three things from the list we take and say we wouldn't borrow them no more. Then he reckoned it wouldn't be no harm to borrow the others. So we talked it all over one night, drifting along down the river, trying to make up our minds whether to drop the watermelons or the cantaloupes or the mushmelons or what. But towards daylight, we got it all settled satisfactorily and concluded to drop crabapples and persimmons. We weren't feeling just right before that, but it was all comfortable now. And I was glad the way it came out, too, because crabapples ain't ever good, and the persimmons wouldn't be ripe for 2 or 3 months yet. I love this story. It's hilarious to me. It's so telling. It's good to laugh at Huckleberry Finn here because he's us. He's all of us. His self deceptive rationalization is hilarious to me. I don't want to be a thief. I don't want to be a stealer. I won't borrow things, he decides, or steal things. And what's the solution? Well, the things I don't like, or the things that aren't ripe yet. And it's funny to me because it's, I think, profoundly true of us as humans. If we're going to develop our character, the very first thing we need to know about ourselves is this. How dangerously blind we can be to our self-justifying motivations. I look at a story like this of Huck Finn, and I just think about all the multiple ways it applies to me in the way I make decisions. For instance, I want to be honest, I don't want to be a thief. But when it comes to illegal downloading, I have some crabapple modifications in the way I view illegal downloading. So, I will not download anything if it's available on iTunes, But if it's not, and it's hard for me to get, or if I have to watch it streaming and there's advertisements, then I feel no harm in stealing it. And it's the Huckleberry Finn motivation. I'm going to be honest and not steal, with certain caveats. Or traffic. I had a wonderful discussion with people this week about traffic, because I was reflecting on my friend Rob, who's an awful driver and very aggressive. And I'm kidding, Rob, you're a great driver. But I was reflecting on the ethics of driving and how some of us like to use, when you're merging and there's the kind of empty lane because it's ending and you have to make a decision, when do you get over? And it's interesting, I have a very firm moral ethic about that. You need to get over and merge as soon as possible. Everybody else does. But if I am in a hurry, then there's a crabapple modification for me, and it makes sense for me to use that lane. And it's fascinating to me how many of us consider ourselves full of values, and yet those values have Huckleberry Finn's crabapple caveat involved. And it speaks to our self-justifying brain. The beginning, then, of forming character is recognizing our propensity to self-justify our own behavior. That in itself is a huge leap, because the thing I admire about Huck Finn is that his ethics are somewhat laughable here, but we can still see his essential morality on display. He is trying to be good. He wants to do the right thing. And he's learning to grow up. And even if he doesn't quite measure up here, even if his decision is mired in self-justification, it becomes a mirror for us. The first step, I think, for us is at least desiring to be good, wanting to make good decisions in life. And yes, it's hard to set aside self-interest, but making good decisions is tough. And in the story of Huck Finn, the reality is there's a whole lot more at stake for him than just stealing. The ultimate story is about Huck and Jim, the runaway slave. And you see, Jim represents a moral dilemma for Huck, because Huck lives in Missouri in a time where slavery was normative. And so Huck is the product of abstract laws. He's constantly wrestling with a decision. Should he turn Jim in or continue sailing on down the river with him? That's a massive struggle for him. If it wasn't a struggle, the story wouldn't be any good. And throughout the story, he vacillates between the two choices. What should he do? Because his upbringing, the morality of his day, says you turn in a runaway slave. And you can see him wrestle in the story. Here's one quick quote. He says this: Jim became thinking about his wife and his kids away up yonder, and he turned into low and homesick due to the fact that he hadn't ever been away from domestic before in his life. And I do believe he cared just as a lot for his people as white oldsters does for his or hern. It don't seem natural, but I reckon it's so. Notice the wrestle. Notice the wrestle there. It's going, my upbringing, the whole social reality for me, the public morals of the day tell me a runaway slave is not a human, and yet he's wrestling with something here because he's seen Jim's pain. And he's seen Jim's story now, and it's softening for him. It's creating a tension. You might say, why am I telling you this story of Huckleberry Finn? I would say it's because it's the exact same story we find in John 8. Exact same story. In Jesus' story, Jesus inherits a norm, a public morality. And the standard of those days is stone a person caught in adultery. And what we get is this lovely portrait of Jesus. He's trying to make a decision based in the values that end up trumping the abstract law and standards of his day. It's a decision that could prove costly for him. And I love the way it plays out. Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone such a woman. What do you say? Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. It's interesting. There's a whole lot of talk about what's going on. Is he writing people's sins? What's he writing? I prefer to think he's stalling. Trying to buy some time. What do you do in a situation like that? You've got a mob mentality, death on his hands. Maybe he's just trying to buy some time. And they keep pressing him, keep questioning him. And he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. I like that it's the older ones who leave first, until Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. But Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and lead your life of sin." The story feels nice and heartwarming, and it's easy, I think, to suppose that we would respond the same way. But the challenge I want to throw to us is this. If we cannot simply refrain from gossiping or slandering others that we know, if we can't find compassion or empathy for the difficult person at work or in our community or on social media, if we can't forgive our partners, husband, wife, children, and the ordinary small details of life, if we can't do those things, how in the hell would we be able to make a decision like Jesus did? Because Jesus is faced with a hard choice. Follow the standard, because that comes easily. Just follow along with what everyone else is doing. Or live into the values you hold. And the story of Huck Finn is so remarkably similar. He has the same choice on his hands. Follow the law. Do what everybody says would be the right thing to do, the honest thing to do. Turn in Jim. In the story, it's fascinating. Huck's conscience is bothering him. He thinks he's going to go to hell if he doesn't turn Jim in. And so, at one point in the story, it's the climax of the story, he writes a letter. He's going to turn Jim in. And after he finishes writing the letter, this is what happens. He says, "I felt properly and all washed easy of sin for the primary time I had ever felt so in my life. And I know that I could pray now, but I did not do it directly off. So I laid the letter down and sat there thinking." I love this because I think there's this hilarious thing Twain's doing here. Huck thinks he isn't praying, but he is praying, I believe. "So I laid the letter down and sat there thinking, questioning how all this passed off so and how close I come to being lost and going to hell. And I went on thinking, and we're given to questioning over our experience down the river, and I see Jim in my mind, but by hook or crook, I could not seem to strike no places to harden me against him. And how he said I changed into the best old pal Jim ever had, and the only one he would give him now. After which I took up the letter and held it in my hand. I changed into a trembling due to the fact I were given to decide forever betwixt matters about Jim, and I noted. I studied a minute, kind of preserving my breath, after which I says to myself, all right, then I'll go to hell, and tore up the letter." I love it. I love it. It's the climax of the story, and Huck chooses hell over violating his own values. Because for Huck, it's loyalty and friendship he values above everything. And his decision is ultimately this: I would rather pay the price of hell than violate who my character fundamentally is, and that is of a loyal friend. And so he essentially says, laws be damned, norms be damned, societal expectations be damned. I don't care. I'm staying true to my values. I don't care what the price is. I will not compromise my values. And I will tell you, in story, these are the people that make the most compelling characters. Think about your favorite story, film, TV, novel. It is the people who will not compromise, for good or ill, their values. They're the ones that stand out, and I would suggest it's the same for us. In life, if we're going to be a compelling character, it means not sacrificing our values. And so we have Jesus and Huckleberry Finn. Both find themselves handed difficult choices. Follow what is normal, what is standard, what the crowd and morality of the day says, or make a choice to live into higher values. It's the exact same for us. We're given the law, the abstract law of public morality, I would say. It could be religious law, it could be social media laws, it could be societal expectations. We all inherit this set of standards, a set of norms, a set of behaviors. That's what we're given. But our character is defined by the choices we make when our values stand at odds with those expectations and norms. What we do in those moments, what we choose, what we decide, defines who we are and the strength of our character. As a father, a husband, a friend, a pastor, a citizen, it doesn't matter what I say my values are. My character is defined by the things I actually do. So characters and stories ultimately boil down to choices. And where there are two choices to be had, there's always a question of values. Why choose this over that? And I think what we need, particularly in church context, is a constant reminder our life choices have unavoidable moral dimensions. And what I've become convinced of is this: what the best stories do, from The Lord of the Rings to Breaking Bad to House of Cards to Hunger Games to Huckleberry Finn, what the best stories do is they remind us good and evil are real. It matters immensely which one of them wins the day. And beyond that, what the best stories do is they insist the way the world looks between good and evil, it depends on people like you and me making the right choices. We've got to make the right choices. As stories teach us, characters choose. That's what they do. Every choice a character makes or we make implies a value, an ought, a because. I do this and not that because, well, because of your values. It's no accident to me that character in storytelling is, of course, something we talk about, but it's also something we talk about with ethics and personal development. Character is defined as the mental and moral qualities distinctive to an individual. Character is also a person in a novel, play, or movie. And they're linked together, and what they mean together is this: character is a person's values in action. And when we talk about building character, we're talking about living out our values. So what are your values? What are they? It's easy when people say things like this question to me to say, family, I value family. What in the world does that mean? Family? That's not a value, that's a platitude. What are your values? What are your values as husband? I want to be loving. Come on, let's be more specific than that. Because the truth is this: all of us are telling a story with our lives. All of us are living into a story. So the question becomes, how do we develop our character in such a way our actions are consistent with our values? The reason this is important is because great stories have great characters. If your life is a story and you want it to be a great story, it requires a great character. You, me, to have great character. Our values are revealed in what we choose and what decisions we make. And it ultimately depends on us playing our parts well. The challenge, of course, is this: the choices we face in life come at us so fast that we don't even really notice we're making them. Daniel Kahneman, in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, he reminds us, he says, our brains have two processing systems, one slow, rational, and conscious, the other fast, emotional, and automatic. What he argues is this: it's the fast, emotional, and automatic part of our minds that are really controlling the choice panel in our minds. It's like the elephant and rider we talked about years ago. In fact, I love this quote by Richard Beck. He says this: the battle to be like Jesus is won or lost in milliseconds. So the challenge is that our brains are moving way too fast for us to simply make better decisions, for me to say, hey, everybody, make better decisions. It's way too simplistic. Developing our character requires intentionality, discipline, formation. And what's interesting to me about the life of Jesus, again, I keep preaching this, is the amount of time he spent in prayer, solitude, connecting with God, in modes of rest when he had time, where he wasn't on, where he was connecting, contemplating. And it's interesting because Mark Twain picks up on this, it's the exact same thing in the story of Huckleberry Finn. What I love about that is Huck Finn's best ethical decisions come from extended times of contemplation where he wrestles with the collective wisdom he has gained and simply spends time in contemplation. And a couple weeks ago, I talked about the discipline, the formative discipline of contemplative prayer, and how I become convinced it's an absolute necessity for us. It is simply not enough to say, make better decisions. It won't happen unless we spend time in contemplative prayer. I typically don't like to share stories of me doing things well. A, because it doesn't happen often, but B, because I hate when preachers are like, look at what I did. I like sharing out of weakness more, so I'll try to do that within the story, but I had a small success yesterday that I directly attribute to contemplative prayer. Kristen's been away the weekend at a wedding in Ottawa, some family things, so I was left alone with the kids, and I know what you're thinking, right? Like, you're a parent, that's what happens. I get it. But But it's not easy. It's tough. I do better when I'm in a role. Chris and I's story is playing out together, and so I knew I had them all day. And I've been reflecting on stories because, reflecting on my own behavior, because I grew up in a family where raising your voice and yelling was winning. So the way Watson's sorted things out is by elevating the tone of our voice. And because my parents were bigger, they won because they could be louder. And you knew when they reached top level, it was like, whoa, okay, better be good. And I think my parents, I love them. I think they did a great job. But from day one, I've always said to myself, I will not yell at my kids. I think it's horrible parenting, and I don't want to be a part of it. And yet, I fail miserably. I lose my temper. I just do. I get worked up, and it tries my patience over little things. And I knew I had them all day yesterday. And again, I've been moving in this contemplative prayer rhythm for myself. And at the beginning of the day, I put them in front of the TV because I need some time. I confess. So I did that so I could do my contemplative prayer. But I set out the day before me. I simply brought it there. I knew it was going to be a tough day. I set out my intentions. I just placed my three little rugrats in a room with Jesus and just contemplated. And at the end of the day, I got them to bed, and Kristen texted me, how did it go? I said, I didn't lose my temper. And she sent me the hallelujah emoji. I did it. And there were times I was trying to get them into their seats, and Evie, she's an issue. She's a problem, and she was bugging me. I was trying to get the seatbelts on, and it wasn't working, and I could feel it's coming. It's a small victory, I get it. Some of you probably don't even care. But I directly attribute it to the ongoing practice I've had of contemplative prayer and being able to ground myself in that and not give in to the story I was raised in. Because that's hard to break. And if you inherited, like I did, a family that yells, and that's how you get things done, that's your automatic response. I wanted to show you something. I'm going to throw it up online. When we think about discipline, Russell Brand, I find him absolutely fascinating. And he posted yesterday a video. I couldn't figure out how to get it on the computer. Prayer in 60 seconds. And coming from him, I thought it was fascinating. So I'm going to throw that up online. He's got a good method for prayer in 60 seconds. I think if we're not developing the habits, the disciplines that allow us to live into a better story, that allow us to reflect on our values, we'll never go anywhere. And our character depends on it. But what is so important about having these kind of practices, I think the truth is, the more we're conscious about the stories we've come from, our roles as characters in them, the more clarity we have about what we value, about who we are and why we're here and how we should act in the world, the better chance we have of developing our characters. I'm going to ask the band to come and close with a song that I think sums this up well. But I would close by saying this. You have choices to make today. Some might be big. My guess is others of them, you're going to have 100 little tiny choices to make today. But the sum of those choices define who you are. It's not what you know. It's not how clever you are or how clever I am. It's not about what we reveal about ourselves on social media. And quite frankly, it has nothing to do with our personality. Our choices define who we are. Our choices define our character. And good characters are the ones who can choose well in the face of tough decisions. So may we all commit to developing our characters so that our lives are telling a story worth living.